welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Fred Monroe is hosting the program from home today amid concerns about the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Fred and his guests will be looking at COVID-19 response efforts and stories. COVID-19 is currently surging across the U.S., including the Central Coast. As of today, California has 1,420,558 confirmed cases of COVID-19, resulting in 20,243 deaths. As cases explode, we are all grappling with another lockdown and the economic and psychological impacts of the pandemic. Join Fred Monroe today as we get updates from Dr. Penny Borenstein, San Luis Obispo County Public Health Officer. Later in the program, we will have a candid discussion with local COVID-19 survivor John Porter, who will share his experience. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation today. Call 805-549-8855 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Rachel. Glad to be with you today. Thank you for everyone joining us. As we tell you often, our goal really is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. We have the pleasure to have my guest with me, but we're not dealing with a pleasurable topic, so I have to temper how I present that. But Dr. Penny Borenstein will be with us in the first half an hour, and we're going to look at basically the overall effects and where we are and the status of what's happening with COVID-19 in our community and statewide issues. In the second half an hour, we'll be joined by John Porter. He is a survivor of COVID, and we'll have a candid discussion about what his experience was like and what he went through, and I believe his learning experience and from some of the things he shared from us in advance will be insightful and enlightening for a lot of us as we move forward with this. Dr. Borenstein, thank you for being with us today. I think you may still be muted in there. So,
yes, thank you.
There we go. Okay. Thank you for joining us. I realize to get a half an hour of your time taxes the world as far as what we're dealing with this topic. It is tough to look at on a regular basis. We are now more than 8 months into yours and ours having to examine it on a very, very concise basis. I want to remind folks that if they have questions, they can email them to voices@kcbx.org or call us at 805-549-8855. If you have a long or complex question, I will pass it on to Dr. Borenstein's office so she can respond to it at a later time. And I encourage you, since Dr. Borenstein will only be with us for the first half an hour of the program, please send your questions over or contact us as soon as possible. And we'll be able to respond as best we can. Dr. Borenstein, I probably want to look at what seems to be at the top of everyone's heap at the moment, which is a feeling that we somehow got lumped in with the Southern California counties, who are in a far more challenging environment than we are right now, and wondering whether or not we need to stay latched into that particular mix of communities and how that's being addressed. I realize you probably don't have concise answers about what the state may or may not let us do, but I suspect it's at the forefront of what people are concerned about.
Yeah, certainly many of the listeners may know that myself and two other jurisdictions, Santa Barbara and Ventura's health officers, as well as their public health directors, I serve both roles in this county. So five of us sent a letter to the director of the state health department asking for consideration that we three counties sort of sink or swim, if you will, on our own with respect to our intensive care unit capacity. We three counties have a long history of collaboration in many health sectors. We are our own mutual aid region when it comes to law enforcement. And so we in response to the public cry for consideration or misunderstanding or downright anger, actually, that we would be held responsible, if you will, our businesses bearing the impact of, you know, what's going on in Imperial County or LA County or San Bernardino, that we be able to have a tighter framework for managing our patient care needs in this region. That also got mirrored by our county board of supervisors, as well as the other two counties, who wrote to the governor to ask for that same consideration. We, however, all of us, based on our expectation of not having success, were we to say, give us that authority right now today, we said, please allow us to exit this region after the minimum 3-week stay-at-home order, lest the greater Southern California region continue to be in a pickle, if you will, or have a challenge with their ICU capacity for many weeks on end, which may be the case. That said, I do want people to understand that we are seeing worsening metrics in our own county. We're certainly seeing them in Ventura and Santa Barbara to some extent. And so I want to have people look at it in both directions, which is, yes, we want to be able to support our businesses and have things bit more open than the stay-at-home order has. We want to be able to financially and emotionally support our businesses, but we really also need our population to heed this moment, that things are getting worse, not just in Southern California, or even way more so in the Central Valley, but in our own area. And so if we are going to continue to make this case that we can do well in this jurisdiction, I really ask of all the listeners and our public at large to do their part to helping us succeed.
We, on a regular basis, we all hear about other members of our community and people across the country who for some reason believe that wearing a mask or being responsible in social distancing is somehow this incredible infringement upon their human rights. I think for those of us who ever see anything on the community bulletin boards like Nextdoor and things like that, we're constantly seeing people who are trying to explain to us that everybody's fear is unfounded. But we see results every day that everybody's fear is indeed founded. We'll talk with John Porter in the second half an hour about the realities of living with having COVID. I'm wondering, are you seeing anything in the way in which people are looking at this crisis that we can somehow reach on a one-on-one basis, if you will, we can reach the public who's still skeptical before it gets to the point where their skepticism is, for lack of a better word, killing us all?
You know, to be quite frank, I'm very perplexed about how we got here. We were all in this together in March. I didn't hear anyone from any walk of life who wasn't concerned about the onslaught of this disease in our country. You know, we didn't know what it would look like in its entirety, but some of the very same people, some of my close colleagues who are now voicing not just, you know, we're not going to treat this as the biggest problem to befall us, but actually actively fighting against any kind of action, as you say, viewing this as an infringement on our rights. I don't get it, because, you know, what I've been spending many nights awake during the evening thinking about is, I don't think that we don't hear the same arguments about I have the right to text while driving. I have the right to drink while driving. I have the right to, stay in my home when I'm being asked to evacuate because there's a big fire coming my way. I have, I keep thinking of more and more metaphors. And I just don't understand how this one at this time, when things really are getting out of control and every single day there is a person in our county who is being killed by a virus because we haven't collectively taken all the measures that we can that are quite frankly rather simple. A piece of cloth across your nose and your mouth, keeping a distance from people, still sharing the love across distance or screens, and sending gifts to people through the mail instead of in person. I understand the business situation is different, but I really believe, and our schools, I want them open. I'm advocating for that. I really believe we can have our cake and eat it too, if people would simply accept that this is a monumental disease that is 15 times worse than seasonal flu. Nearly 300,000 people have died. And it is within our hands to bring it under control while we wait for the vaccine.
Statistically speaking, when you do tracing of cases, are you able to get a sense of how many of those are tied to people who have happened to be in the wrong part of the environment when it happens, or people who are indeed part of the raising their middle finger to the concept of wearing a mask?
So I largely have anecdote in that arena, because more and more are contact tracers who are doing this important work out of love for their fellow neighbors and citizens. Yes, they're getting a paycheck, but they really want to help us with the response. And they are getting more pushback from some of the people. So we do ask, you know, what kinds of gatherings were you at, when, you know, the timing, and, you know, do you have other people who were infected and where was that at? But we don't have, we cannot get down to the granular level of, yes, it was at restaurant X on Tuesday that I know was the only possibility of where I got this disease. So what I can say is we continue to understand that most people who have gotten this disease can cite that they were in some type of gathering, whether it was in a private home or a restaurant or other type of facility. People are just moving out and about in the community to a large extent in the same way as they were months ago when we did not have this level of disease. And so you didn't hear from me with the same level of consideration. You know, many months ago, people can go back and fault me and say I didn't do a county mask mandate. And I kept saying we will only take these more dramatic actions that do infringe to some degree. It's not comfortable to wear a mask. We will only take those actions when necessary. They are necessary right now. As I said, people are dying every day from this disease, and we're asking for some, you know, small gestures of support for fellow citizens. So to your question, though, of can we tell exactly where all the disease is spreading, and is it people who are not complying with the rules? Yes, to some extent, you know, people who are still continuing to gather, again, whether in their own homes or in other settings, including outdoors, we do have some insights that is the case. And many, some will say, some absolutely say, yep, no big deal. I'm fine. I feel fine. I don't wear a mask. Most will not give us that information, or many will say, yeah, I don't know how I got this. I've done everything right. So it's across the board. But we do know, as I continue to get asked very much lately, I will not shut down business X unless you prove to me that my business is a source of transmission, that is no longer an operational consideration, because all those places are potential sources of transmission. And so we are asking for people to move about the community in different ways right now.
I think in some cases, hopefully what we'll see is people who will self-select. The businesses that I want to support, if I need to be out and about at all, I'd like to support businesses who feel like they're on the same page I am to be positive about getting through this experience, as opposed to being rebellious about getting through this experience. So I'm sure that along with the frustration that you and your department are feeling, I'm hoping that you are hearing from some people who are feeling like they're more part of the solution if they can stay on board with your recommendations. But I'm sure it's frustrating.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would say the majority of our county's residents get it. They're doing everything they can. I don't mean to sound as if I'm being critical of our business operators, because I really do understand the pressures they're under, and I really want to help them by getting all of their users and community members to do better. It's this really double-edged sword that we're faced with. And what I think our business community really needs at this moment in time is financial relief, so that they can, more comfortably be part of the solution. I completely understand the dichotomy, the challenge, the anxiety for a business of, am I going to still do business so that I can keep my head above water, or comply and shut everything down and then potentially lose my business. I want to do everything we can and point those people to financial relief that is in existence, ask them to lobby at the state and federal level for immediate additional fiscal relief, as opposed to just saying, stop the lockdowns, stop the shutdowns. This isn't happening. It's not important. I think we can do both.
Okay, thank you. One of the key discussion items that is out there for everybody right now is the fact that we really are at the point, literally within hours of getting approval for the vaccination of people in this country. There's this underlying theme that we hear, which is the fact that there won't be enough vaccinations for everybody for quite some time. Some numbers that you'd put out is that there'll be about 325,000 vaccinations for the state of California, of which our county will likely see at the first blush of this about 2,000. The discussion has been around who gets those first. I don't think anyone in their right mind is going to believe that making sure our healthcare providers and our first responders are first in line for that, because we need them to stay well for all of us, even though we'd like to keep everyone safe. But the question has come up as to whether or not nursing homes will be the next group in line in San Luis Obispo County, because we don't see ourselves as a rural county, but I think in the overall scheme of national medicine, we're probably a rural county. And I'm wondering how we're going to balance that out, and what kind of real timeline are we looking at? 2,000 doses is not going to get us very far.
Right. So we've gotten estimates and by very particular sector of about 17,000 people who meet the definition of a healthcare worker. We anticipate getting considerably more than 2,000 doses with the first shipment. That 1,950 is going to come to the local health department, but our hospitals are going to get their own shipments, and they are just in the process today or tomorrow learning what that number will be for our local hospitals. We have it for Dignity and for Tenet, our two hospital systems, as well as for ASH and CMC. We have it on a statewide level for those sectors, for those, multi-county entities. But I imagine that there will be additional thousands of doses in our county for those groups, our hospitals. In addition, absolutely the first groups that will be eligible to receive vaccine is through a partnership between pharmacies, CVS, largely in this county, and a couple of Walgreens, for them to actually go to the long-term care facilities in our county and administer vaccine to not only the workers in those facilities, but the residents in those facilities. And they are in the very first group for whom the vaccine is recommended. So yeah. The one other thing I want to add, the approval process that's going on today is for the Pfizer vaccine. We are prepared to accept that deep freeze vaccine. But shortly on the heels of that is another product that won't need quite as much delicate handling. And we anticipate doubling or tripling the amount of vaccine that will be coming to our county still within potentially the month of December.
Yeah, the second product, the Moderna product, is that what it is?
Yes.
That requires less ginger yes. care, if you will.
Yes, it's still a frozen vaccine, but it's not at these ultra low temperatures.
Yeah, we did get an email from Trudy in Arroyo Grande that talked about the fact there's been a lot of discussion, and you've mentioned it now, about getting the vaccine out for care facilities. Her concern, and I believe she raises a very valid point, is that a lot of people in their 70s and 80s and into their 90s are not in a care facility type environment. They're still reasonably active and independent. Are they going to have a difficult time getting put in the queue for vaccines while you're looking at those, if you will, captive populations like hospitals and care facilities?
Yeah, so that group is in the second phase of the vaccination effort, but before the general public. So this very first phase of limited doses is aimed specifically at healthcare workers and residents of these facilities who are more vulnerable to severe outcomes and death, as we've seen across the world. But it is absolutely true that individuals of an older age who may be fine living independently do also have higher risk should they become infected with COVID. And so that group, by virtue of age, as well as even younger people who have other health conditions that puts them at higher risk, are considered to be a phase 1B of this vaccination effort. So as the supply chain loosens up, then after healthcare workers, the vaccine will be aimed at older individuals, people with medical conditions, as well as additional essential workers, first responders, people who make all of our systems run, transportation, water systems, et cetera. That is a very large group, and we don't know the timeline for getting adequate vaccines in hand for that second, much larger group. But there is absolutely consideration for those individuals being ahead of the general populace.
I don't want to make you come up with a figure that we're going to come back and yell at you about later on, but I think everyone wants to know, and as we look at the evolution of getting the vaccine out, we'll have two available. There's a third one possibly even on the way also. Is there a realistic point at which you could say everyone in San Luis Obispo County, everyone on the Central Coast, I'd like to say everyone in the world, but I can't, I realize that is outside of your scope of authority at the moment, is whether or not we can say that there will be vaccines available for anyone who chooses to have one by a certain date or a certain point in history. Are we looking at not till next July or August? Are we looking at March or April? What are the possibilities?
So my crystal ball is broken, but I would note that I recently heard from the medical director of Operation Warp Speed, which is the entity that's overseeing all the vaccination trials and the FDA approvals that are coming down the pike. And the most recent assessment of when we will have a large enough vaccine volume is probably more like summertime. Thank you for telling me you won't hold me to that, because I have no control over it. And because there are quite a few other, AstraZeneca is the third one that's closest to completion of phase 3 clinical trials. But there are quite a few others that are in the pipeline. And You know, it really remains to be seen how these work in terms of, you know, viability coming off the production chain and how quickly they can ramp up that manufacturing process. So it's an unknown, but I think it's not unreasonable to think that general population access to vaccine might come as soon as summer of 2021.
Well, that's not as encouraging as I would have liked to have heard, but at least we have a vision out there. And obviously we're dealing with a product that already exists. It's just a matter of making enough of it and getting it distributed.
And I hope that I'm wrong in the by estimating late.
And Dr. Bornstein, I hope you're wrong. But and thank you for your candor with that. I really appreciate it. Because we're a semi-rural county, are we looking at having a tug of war with the larger population centers in the state of California? Or is it really not going to be a factor because California is a pretty medically advanced part of the country?
With respect to vaccination or care? Or both.
I think vaccination is the key thing because care is not quite as predictable, I think.
Right. So no, all of the allocation decisions are being made on the basis of targeted populations and a lot of data aggregation and collection that's being done at the state level. We're able to some extent to validate the numbers that we're being told exist for our county. There's definitely proportionate distribution of the vaccines as they are becoming available.
Yeah. One of the other topics, we're almost out of time. I want to take a look at when we look at the testing situation, you and your department have done a tremendous amount of effort to get more testing available within the county. And I think it's unclear to a lot of us where the balance is between what testing gives you for the general population versus only testing people who are already reporting symptoms.
I think our expansive testing, and actually for weeks now, I think we slipped a little bit this past week, but for at least 3 or 4 weeks, we were second only to San Francisco in the per capita testing that we were doing. Per capita. I'm sorry. Total testing in San Luis Obispo County was second only to San Francisco for at least 3 weeks in the number of tests available through the state database. We're very proud of that. We have put a huge emphasis in this county to making testing available. And we think it is critically important to the solution for managing this disease is you cannot turn a blind eye and only test people who are symptomatic. 40 to 45% of people who have the disease and can transmit the disease are people who don't report symptoms or don't report symptoms at the time that they test positive. They may go on to have symptoms. We think it is absolutely essential to our strategy to control this disease in our jurisdiction. And quite frankly, I think that has been one of our winning strategies and why we have up till now done considerably better than other places.
I have watched you, I've watched your staff, and I am confident that you know what you're doing and you're doing it right to the best of your ability. And I appreciate that. As I remind listeners all the time, I want to get out of the way and make sure that my guests have a chance to have the last word on their own topic. So you've got a couple of minutes if you can, Penny. What have we missed or not covered adequately that you want to make sure that our listeners understand and pay attention to as we move forward in this pandemic?
I guess I just really want to remind the public that we Americans, we San Luis Obispans, have been through tragic times before. And we can do this again. We did it in 1918 with a terrible pandemic. We did it during World War II. We did it during a depression. These are not easy times for anyone. And it really does not help us if we fracture our approach to how to best get through this pandemic. It is the virus that's our enemy, not each other. And we at the county will absolutely support our citizens in all ways that are necessary, financial support, emotional support through services, through food distribution, through exercise opportunities, et cetera. But please work with us to help us as a larger community gain control of this virus by taking those same measures that I say over and over and over again, which is wear a mask, stay distanced from people who are not in your household, wash your hands as often as you can, use hand sanitizer, do not gather, do not mix across households, and absolutely stay home if you're not feeling well.
Thank you. We'll leave it with that. Dr. Borenstein, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Thank you for you and all of your staff for doing the very best you can to keep us safe.
Thank you, Fred.
I appreciate you joining us today. We'll be back with you in just a moment. I'll have John Porter with us, who is a survivor of COVID, and we'll have a candid discussion about what this is that has gone on and the kind of things that Dr. Borenstein's been talking about. We'll be back with you momentarily.
This is listener-supported public radio, KCBX. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. This is Central Coast Voices. If you have questions you want to have answered, you can send them to us at voices@kcbx.org or call them into us at 805-549-8855. Back to you, Fred.
Thank you, Rachel. Glad you could be with us today. Want to thank Dr. Borenstein for a candid conversation. Our second half an hour will be just as candid as the first in a different focus, but same general topic. John Porter is a local survivor of COVID. He has had the experience in a fashion that none of us can probably understand, which is one reason why he's here, because very few of us have the opportunity to talk directly with someone who has been through this experience. And it's different for everyone, I'm sure, but it's something that I hope obviously no one ever has to go through if they can learn from your experience. You want to give us a little background? Obviously you are John Q. Public, if you will, as a COVID survivor at this point. So tell us a bit about what got you to here.
Thank you, Fred. Back in March, which was, nobody could find a mask in those days. It was hard to do. I took two different airline flights locally in the first half of the month. I suspect I caught it on one of those, but as you were saying earlier, there's no way to know. Towards the end, about the 20th or so, I started getting a tickled throat, coughing, and it progressed to the point where my wife got me a doctor's appointment. I went in on the 25th. He tested me for pneumonia, did a chest x-ray. Those came back positive, so he did the COVID swab that we've all heard about, which is lovely. I got the results the next day. The 28th, I was hospitalized. It had just gotten really bad. I mean, we've all had a bad flu. Multiply this times 5. It was awful. On March 30th, I was improving a little bit. The doctors told my wife, maybe we'll send him home. The next thing I know was about April 12th, I woke up after having been on the ventilator from the early on the morning of the 1st until the 11th. the 11th and 12th, I don't really remember too much about. Those are basically almost 2 weeks of just lost time. I wasn't there. And we spent the next...
I want to interject for a second. Were you conscious through most of that?
No.
Or you literally have no memory of that period
out.
Of time?
It they was like a... Out.
Okay. Okay.
From the time I woke up, I was weak. I mean, really weak. I could hardly lift my arms. And we basically spent the next 2.5 weeks getting me strong enough to where I could shuffle off to the bathroom by myself unaided before they sent me home on May 1st. So I was actually in Sierra Vista for almost 5 weeks, intubated for technically 11, but, you know, knocked out for 12 or 13 days of that. From the time I woke up on, I actually felt fairly decent. I was on all sorts of drugs. Couldn't even give you the list of them. But from the time I did that, it was mainly just strength building before I could get out of the hospital. But it's not something I recommend at all.
One of the key things you talk about in some of the notes that you sent us beforehand, because we asked for some background and some general information, what Wordy was surprising, and that is there are probably 5 members of your family that ended up with COVID, maybe because of being exposed by you. And you mentioned 2 of those people specifically don't think they ever had the disease, but tested positive for antibodies.
Yeah,
So in your surrounding family, how did this all evolve out?
They got it, I'm sure, from me. But they were a week to 10 days behind me on the scheduling. So by the time I was in the hospital and out, they were sick. And it ranged anywhere from 1 asymptomatic to my youngest son had it for about 10 days. But he didn't go in and get tested or wasn't sick enough to go to the hospital. So it was a whole range.
How old was
he? He's 31.
Okay, so this is an adult, not a pre-legal child.
Correct. Yeah. Although my grandson was here at the time, and he got sick. And he was 3 at the time. Not badly sick, but he did get it.
So, but it was obvious that he had something going on because we've heard from a lot of people that allegedly for small children it's not as big a factor, but then there are surprises.
That's right.
I'm assuming, but I can't be, but I shouldn't make any assumptions on the radio. I shouldn't make assumptions at all that you have been tested for antibodies since then.
Yes,
or you have not.
I'm still tested positive. My last test was about a month ago. And still testing positive, as is my wife and my middle son, who was the asymptomatic one.
Is the recommendation from your medical professionals that, because we've heard both pro and con to whether or not you can get it again. Is the advice from your medical practitioners that you still need to be extra careful?
Yes, absolutely. They're telling us to just assume you can get it again. If you don't, you're lucky. Which, of course, brings up another point, maybe Dr. Bornstein, if she's still listening. When do those of us who have had COVID get our vaccines?
Yeah. And I don't know that we have the answer to that right now, but I think it's a good question. And I can assure you I'll pass it along by email to Dr. Bornstein if she's not still on the call. Were these symptoms that you, one of the things that comes up often is people say this because the symptoms seem like they are the same for the flu, but that it becomes worse. Did you feel like you were in a situation of whether or not you could know that, hey, this is indeed not the flu?
The first few days, you're right. It was, geez, do I have the flu? Do I not? Do I have COVID? Do I not? There's really no way to tell in those first few days. The symptoms are, you know, they vary obviously, but they were pretty light the first couple of days and then just progressively got worse until I was pretty sure I had it prior to the test. That was just confirmation. And by then it was really, like I said, the worst flu you've ever had.
By the way, we got a note back. Dr. Bornstein sent me a note, and she basically said that you would still be eligible for vaccination within your age group, regardless of whether or not you'd had prior disease.
Okay, good.
Okay, so that's a key factor for you, and that's certainly going to be important, because at this point, I guess we don't know how long it will or will not be. People will still be susceptible to getting it back again.
Correct.
We don't have enough history yet, and we certainly would not like to answer that question the hard way.
And my worry was more, I've got antibodies still. Is this going to give me too many antibodies, which I know is kind of a stupid statement, but is there a secondary problem that could come up because I've already got antibodies? And I think with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, that's not going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I that may be in the information category of, as more people get vaccines, they'll have more case information to work with from that standpoint.
Yes.
How are you feeling now? I mean, because we're this has been 7 months later,
or yeah. 8 months later. I feel pretty good. I am considered a long haul patient. I do have some problems, but nothing critical. I've kind of been forced into retirement because of it. I'm mostly having strength and stamina problems, but I actually feel good.
Because you were obviously one of the early cases that ended up in a hospital environment, not only early for San Luis County, but pretty early for the United States. Mm-hmm. Was this a tug of war with your insurance at all?
No, I just started Medicare several months before and never heard a word from them.
Well, in one of your comments in the material with us, you were basically suggesting that it may be a good quiz for people to try and figure out how much this costs to treat.
Yeah, yeah.
You were in the hospital for 17 days?
No, I was in the hospital almost 5 weeks.
5 weeks, sorry, okay.
Ventilated for 11, had an x-ray, a CAT scan in one area, and a ton of medicine. So yeah, people can guess what the retail bill would have been and then guess how much Medicare paid.
Did you end up with any personal bill at all on this other than the small amount of Medicare copay, or did you not even have that?
No, I've got the supplementals, thankfully, and there were only a few really minor things that they didn't cover. Luckily.
Yeah. The rest of your family, they're all doing well now?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So of the people in your family that were exposed to it with you, most people were asymptomatic or had very, very little in the way of discomfort and complications?
Yeah. One asymptomatic. The rest of them had a mild to moderate flu, anywhere from 2 to 3 days, with the exception of my one son who had it for about 10 days.
Are you vocal on social media about this kind of stuff?
I try not to get too political about it, but every once in a while something sets me off and I just have to blast out, you know, some things that probably I wouldn't want to repeat on the radio. But
well, without you responding to that question with specifics for your commentary in social media, can you share with us some of the kinds of skepticism that you may have faced in a diplomatic way, if possible, John?
Well, it's funny. When I came back and the first couple of times I went to our local store, people recognized me. Hey, how you doing? Haven't seen you. And I'd say, oh, yeah, I was in the hospital with COVID. And it was always with them, oh, my God, how are you? What are you doing? Some stranger in line behind me would go, you know, I think I had that in February. I was pretty sick. And then, but on social media, the filters go away and it's everything from, oh, it's a hoax. The numbers aren't right. You know, it's political masks. You don't need, you know, you name it, you've seen them all. And I pull my hair out, what's left of it, and don't know. I realize the percentages aren't real high. That's true. but you always get the one guy that says, oh, I could get hit by a bus next week. Well, that's true, yeah. But you mitigate that. You don't jaywalk without looking.
Okay, that explains then the question I was going to ask about, because somewhere in your notes you did basically say that one of your best explanations to people is don't jaywalk without looking.
Yeah, so and that goes back.
I appreciate you putting that in context. Okay.
Yeah, you don't jaywalk without looking. You wear a mask when you go out. It's the same mitigation, as far as I'm concerned.
Of the three people that I personally know, you're now the fourth because we now have met today. Mm-hmm. But other than you, of the three people I personally know who have had COVID or have COVID, one of them still does. Mm. Two of those three are people who are what I classify as anti-maskers that okay. actually believe this is all a hoax. One of those two people is still ill and still believes it's a hoax. So it's I don't know how we address that.
I don't either, and it amazes me. I mean, were these people absent the day they taught seventh grade science? And if so, how did they graduate from high school? I don't get it either. I wish I had an answer, but I don't.
Yeah. Extended family using you as a good benchmark to pay attention to. In other words, are you hearing from your cousin in Ohio that you haven't heard from in a long time, saying, okay, tell me about this and whether or not I can explain to my family why I wear a mask? I'm serious question.
Tennessee, but no, I haven't heard from her, but she would be on my side. But I have some local relatives that are in the anti-masking camp, and they're just adamant. They know perfectly well I almost died, but they're not wearing their mask.
Well, they may be. I'm wondering if they're telling you now that they don't believe that you're susceptible to the disease anymore, so they're not worried about you.
Well, I don't talk to them that often, but
I have to keep. Yeah, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. If I had relatives like that, I probably wouldn't talk to them often either.
Yeah. You know, they're your relatives, and you get together once in a while. But except for being a relative, you wouldn't normally talk to them. You're right.
The 5 weeks you were in the hospital. So about a little more than two of those 5 weeks, you have little recollection of what went on.
That's right.
Beyond the need, but that went on, that predated needing to be on a ventilator, and mm-hmm. it postdated being on a ventilator and recovering from that. Mm-hmm. What was the decision to keep you in the hospital as you understand it?
They were, because I actually tested positive all the way out to 4 days before they discharged me. And they couldn't find a hospice or anywhere to take me to do my physical training, get me back up to speed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I literally for probably 4 or 5 days couldn't even turn over in bed. You know, it was that weak.
Oh, my.
And, you know, when you, I don't want to be too gross about this, but you wake up at 2 a.m. and, got to go to the bathroom. You ring the bell and they look at you and you point to the toilet, and it takes them 3 or 4 minutes to gown up and get in there. And those first few days, that was too late. Not to put a fine point on it, but, and so they wanted to make sure that I was able to get up, motor around the house, at least, you know, more or less by myself before they discharged me.
How you've kind of implied that you don't really see yourself as completely recovered now. You don't have all your strength back.
Right.
What are you doing, or what are you doing with either physical therapy or other medical assistance to regain your strength? And is the projection that you will regain all of your strength?
They sent me out and hooked me up with a physical therapist for 4 trips about 5 days apart. And then an occupational therapist who more worked on fine motor. I couldn't even hold a pen. It was that bad.
Oh, my.
So she worked on that with me. And I got to the point where they gave me exercises to do. So I'm getting out a couple, 2 or 3 times a week. And I've got a little park just up the hill here. I go up there, walk around. And it's, other than that, it's just doing things around the house so that if something does happen, at least I'm here. not pushing it. You know, my wife wouldn't let me drive for about 6 weeks after I got home. I mean, when I got home, it was still pretty touch and go on could I even walk around the yard? And I don't think the answer was yes for another week or so. The prognosis, they're pretty sure I probably have some lung scarring from the pneumonia. They're going to test that again in about a month and a half, I guess.
Obviously, if you were eligible for Medicare reasonably soon before this, mm-hmm. That puts you on the edge of the population that is considered the most vulnerable for this.
Correct.
Based upon what you're saying, I'm older than you are, so I can say this. It's we're in a population that this is considered a pretty high risk for. I'm frightened about possibly getting COVID every day.
You should be.
And I think I'm about 4 years older than you are.
Okay. And yeah, it's like I tell people, I've had it. You don't want it. And especially as you get up into our age bracket, you know, the numbers just get worse and worse. So, yeah, do whatever you can. And I urge all your listeners, take it seriously. You know, yes, you may not get it. But, boy, if you do, it's no fun.
And there are a number of people who've gotten it, a couple of them in your family who are asymptomatic, which means they may have been able to expose other people in a fashion that would not be good for those folks, even though they walked away with no knowledge of being ill.
That's true. And although I will say from my test, which was late in the afternoon, they're the positive result anyway. To say on the 26th, Penny Bornstein's office called it that day and put the house under quarantine. Mm-hmm. And then we weren't released fully until I'd been home about 5 or 6 more days, I think.
Yeah. Other than physical therapy and decisions for your own strength training, mm-hmm. What other medical procedures are in the process right now to get you back to as healthy as possible?
The easy ones are I've done a couple of blood tests for my primary, and he noticed I was a little bit low on my thyroid function on the first test, put me on some drug or another. And then that came back the second time a month ago, came back normal. We're going to do, like I say, a chest x-ray and maybe a CT scan the next time I go in, just to check out my lungs. So that seems to be where it hit me the worst.
Did you have any respiratory issues at all beforehand?
No. No, I was in good shape.
Even a healthy male in his mid-60s, mm-hmm. it's still a slap in the face that you don't want to ever have to think about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And you see the really sad stories on TV of the people in their 30s and 40s dying and were in good shape. So yeah, it's across the board.
Yeah. There's a very touching story and very sad story about a woman who just gave birth to a child and died from COVID within the same day or two.
I saw that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. I sit here and I watch these stories and I think, God, these poor people. Then I realize, wait, I was one of them.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that was a particularly sad one.
Yeah. You were one of them, and I appreciate you being willing to be on the radio and talk to us about this today. As I tell all of my guests, because I talk too much, I want to make sure that you get the last word about this. And I would encourage my only comment about your comments before I let you jump in is I think the best thing you said was don't jaywalk without looking, which is what an awful lot of people are doing who believe this is never going to affect them.
Yeah, there's that. There's, you know, it's the multifaceted problem. It's not just you get sick and you get well. There's financial, like I said, with me, I'm probably finished with my career. My wife had PTSD, well, probably still has PTSD from the whole experience. And you know, you can imagine what somebody who walks into the hospital with no insurance, they get the full retail bill. And I guess I'll tell you now, my bill from Medicare just for the hospital was $1,004,000.
It's a significant amount of money.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that would have obviously wiped you out. I'm sure it would wipe out anybody.
Yeah. Even with, you know, insurance paying part of it, most of us don't have 100% insurance. And they've negotiated it down to $150,000, $200,000, whatever it is. But imagine paying 20% of that.
Yeah.
That would hit most of us pretty hard.
Yeah. Any other last thoughts?
Be well. Stay safe. That's all you can do. Wear your mask. You know, all the things that Dr. Bornstein said at the end of her segment. It's really a frightening thing.
Yeah. I would observe the following, John, and that is I'm going to think about you every time I put a mask on. I wear one on a regular basis when I'm out of the house, which is seldom. But I thank you truly for being willing to be part of this discussion. Yeah. There's enough people who know you, I believe, that everybody around your community will know that you were the guy on KCBX today talking about your experience.
And I was also the guy, probably nobody saw it, but I was also the guy that was on KSBY late at night when they wheeled me out of the hospital. That was also me.
So now we can attach some film to radio, and that will put it all together for you.
There you go.
Okay. Brett, John, thank you very much. I appreciate you being candid with us. I wish you a full recovery. I am glad you're still with us to talk now, and I appreciate truly your candor and your willing to be with us on this program.
Thank you very much, thank Fred. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. This has been Central Coast Voices. I want to remind you all that Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week. We don't have her show finalized yet, so stay tuned for more information about when that program is going to come your way, which will be next Thursday at 1 o'clock. We're just not quite sure what her topic of discussion will be. Want to also remind you that you can reach us at voices@kcbx.org at any time, even when we're not on the air, with questions or concerns you may have. Want to thank KCBX Public Radio for their partnership with this. Their listener-supported public radio. That means you as a listener, hopefully, are supporting KCBX. Also, thanks to our studio engineer today, Rachel Showalter. And thank you to my guests, Dr. Penny Borenstein from the County Health Department, and John Porter, a true survivor of COVID. And hopefully for John, if for no one else, you'll wear your mask every chance you get and keep the social distancing so we all get to be around for this time next year to have more discussions. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us.